everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Ronen Omer Sherman, who teaches at the University of Louisville. Here to talk about his new book, Imagining the Kibbutz, Visions of Utopia in Literature and Film, published this year by the Pennsylvania State University Press. Ronen, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thanks very much, Jason.
Well, it's great to have you. So let's start with a little background. Can you tell us what is the kibbutz?
Absolutely. For a very basic definition, I'll just start off by saying that this is the purest and most sustained form of socialism that the world has ever known. The kibbutz, which we can basically define that as the Hebrew word for communal settlement, was originally established as a rural community that was dedicated to mutual aid and social justice. It was a socioeconomic system based entirely on the principle of the joint ownership of property, equality, cooperation of production, consumption, education. In other words, it was the ideal fulfillment of the concept from each according to his or her ability to each according to his or her needs. And the first kibbutzim were actually founded several decades before Israel itself. The very first of these is Degania, which comes from the Hebrew word Dagan, meaning grain, and that was located just south of the Sea of Galilee, Lake Kinneret, established in 1909 by a group of pioneers on land that was purchased by the Jewish National Fund. Degania, as well as most kibbutzim of that era, were founded by young Jewish pioneers that came primarily from Eastern Europe for obvious reasons, because of the prevalence of communism and different variations on socialism that flourished in that part of the world. The other thing that I would say that distinguishes that first effort is that they were years of tremendous struggles. Many of the immigrants found that they could not live up to the demands of living on the land. There was a lot of malaria. They had very little experience with the demands of physical labor, a general lack of agricultural know-how, the scarcity of water, and really a shortage of supporting funds, miserable living conditions.
For that first generation, even a little bit afterwards, the kibbutz was not only a place, right? It was also sort of an ideological project. Is that right?
Absolutely. The kibbutz, as I said, was about absolute equality in the beginning, and with varying degrees of success later on, there was also an idea of egalitarianism, that women and men would both have the same opportunity for fulfilling themselves by living and working on the land. And that's one of the primary reasons for the collective children's education. Children are being raised for a number of decades completely outside of the home, freeing up men and women to completely devote themselves to labor, except for a few hours. Very few hours of the day in which they could have contact with the children in the children's houses. The ideal of the kibbutz is actually reflected in the physical layout of the kibbutz. If you've seen one kibbutz, even though they can vary in terms of minor arrangements, most of them are laid out to a very similar plan. You have a residential area that encompasses usually very carefully tended members' homes and private gardens. But the areas surrounding the home and inside the home are one of the primary places for the individual self-expression, whatever choices a person wants to make to decorate their inside homes and exteriors. Children's houses and playgrounds for every age group. Communal facilities were primarily the dining hall, the auditorium, libraries, sometimes swimming pools that were introduced later on, tennis courts, medical clinics, especially for those that were isolated from major cities and towns, laundries, groceries. And then adjacent to the living quarters would be sheds for the dairy cattle, modern chicken coops, agricultural fields on the periphery, fish ponds also, orchards, usually just a short tractor ride from the center. And kibbutzim can be quite spacious, quite expansive. To get around internally, people would tend to walk or sometimes ride bicycles. the elderly and the disabled who were from the very beginning included in the design of kibbutzim were provided for the disabled. And so the disabled and elderly, I meant to say, were afforded electric carts, and their needs were taken care of. And they were also given opportunities to continue to work even after formal retirement, so that they never felt that they were parasites in the community and had a sense of a vibrant connection to what was going on.
So the book is not really a history of the kibbutz so much as a study of the imaginative portrayals of the kibbutz. What is the vision of utopia in the book's title?
So visions of utopia reflects on the fact that what I see happening from the very beginning, and you're right to distinguish this as very much not a history. The history of the kibbutz movement has been told by many others, and a lot of people have focused on sociological aspects of the kibbutz, such as the phenomena of the children's house, its golden age and its decline later on, and all sorts of even architectural studies of the kibbutz have been done. But what I noticed as a kibbutznik, as one who lived on kibbutz for 13 years, was that there was always a vibrant kind of literature of skepticism or questioning written by kibbutz insiders, some of them very famous and well-known outside of Israel and some lesser known. And so imagining the kibbutz was really about what happens when the hardcore reality, sometimes a disappointing reality of kibbutz, meets the writer's imagination. Most of the works that I dealt with, but not all, were written by kibbutz insiders, some of them living their lives, entire lives in kibbutzim, or at least significant periods of their lives.
Well, maybe we'll talk about this in a minute, but there's some interesting differences, I thought, between the insiders and the outsiders' representations. Can you tell us just briefly about your 13 years on the kibbutz? What sort of stands out?
Okay, so I left the United States as a 17-year-old on my own in 1975, kind of a starry-eyed, naive teenager. For instance, I didn't really understand the concept of the Palestinians as a people. I think that is not atypical of many Jews of my generation. But I was especially drawn to the idea of starting a young kibbutz, a new kibbutz. I'd already spent time on a kibbutz as a volunteer in 1974. And when I graduated the high school, college just didn't seem right for me. And the idea of an adventure, the idea of this kind of fulfilling commitment, the idea of working on the land, especially settling the desert, which is where I ended up, was an incredible lure. And there are times in my life right now as an academic that I really can't shake myself from the nostalgia of those years, because much of it was quite wonderful.
What does a study of the kibbutz tell us about Israeli society more broadly?
Okay, so I think that the kibbutz narrative essentially functions as a microcosm of the great drama of Israeli society, which is the relationship between the individual and the collective, something that is not often thought about in the United States. And I try to illuminate what I consider this deep structure of both Israeli society and the literature that responds to that society, which is the clash between individual desires and unyielding national imperatives, which sometimes requires the sacrifice, the literal sacrifice of the individual. One of the things that I encountered over the years, and this began for very personal reasons, I should say, when I was caught up in the kibbutz dream myself, there was a lot of euphoria, and there was a time when I just felt that I was living a dream. But living in a very, very small society can also lead to a lot of doubt and moments of tension and estrangement. And I became an enamored reader of Amos Oz very, very young. And I saw that a lot of the issues of loneliness and alienation that I think a lot of us struggling to be part of the collective felt were beautifully explored in his narratives. And it was much, much later as an academic that I found how many other writers devoted themselves to the idea of the kibbutz. One of the things that I discovered is that in the earliest kibbutz narratives of the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, there the individual character, the hero, heroine, the protagonist is always being tested. there's an important shift that happens later on, where the collective itself seems to bear the burden of demonstrating the degree that it can accommodate the individual's aspirations and the individual's weaknesses. And I think this demarcation begins in the 1960s because there's a growing restlessness, the youth movement that's sweeping through the entire world. And I think that the radical changes that we've seen with the kibbutz in very recent years, the privatization model, the movement away from radical fulfillment of the socialist idea toward more kind of selfish, individual, egotistic model that began in the 1960s.
Let's talk about some of the early portrayals. I thought that was an interesting chapter. It was interesting to see an American Jewish writer included in there, Meyer Levin, right? In the midst of the Great Depression, this is the guy who wrote about Leopold and Loeb, the famous Chicago case. In the midst of the Great Depression, he's writing about this, you know, economic project in Israel. Is that right?
That's correct.
What is very basically the story of Yehuda?
So Yehuda is very interesting to me, and I think kind of typical of what I saw in that generation with Israeli writers, or rather writers who came from Russia. He is actually interested in the struggle of the individual to adapt and to be part of the burden of the collective and remaking themselves. There was a lot of emphasis in the early kibbutz narrative, as in Zionism itself, of the individual being reborn by contact with the land. That's what it meant to be a chalut, to completely remake yourself and sort of wean yourself or purge diaspora out of you, purge the galut out of you. And there's a sense of measuring up to this burden, of measuring up to what's required of you.
So the early portrayals put a lot of the emphasis on the individual journey, is that right?
Yes, and already there's a lot of doubt, not just doubts about the individual, but also questions about whether the collective would be able to accommodate even a transformed version of Jewishness, whether there would be any room for spirituality alongside in a life that's completely devoted to solving all sorts of pragmatic problems. Would there be any room for spirit and even cultural expression? Because there was actual sort of official movement bias directed toward imaginative expressions. One was not supposed to come to the kibbutz to be a poet or a writer. Or if so, then you had to be a kind of doctrinaire poet or writer. You weren't supposed to express ambivalence.
Let's talk about chapter two. To the extent that any of the writers that you talk about are household names, I would say Amos Oz is maybe, you know, the most well-known. Why is he so important to this genre?
Okay, so first of all, Amos Oz was one of the first truly dedicated kibbutz writers. There were others, but he was very interesting in that he fled to kibbutz as a very, very young person, left behind a very intellectual household because he believed that what was happening authentically with Jews had nothing to do with city life. It was either in the Negev, in the desert, or it was in the Galilee. That is where real Zionism was happening. And that's a myth that he, I think, adhered to until he actually found himself as a young person on kibbutz that, in spite of himself, turned out to be kind of bookish. And he writes very, very acerbically already in his 20s of the limits of the kibbutz dream in accommodating individuals and the loneliness, the estrangements that can follow that. And so I was always very, very moved by the fact that he revered the kibbutz, but he saw it as a system that was wonderful, but could never ultimately resolve what it means to be a flawed human being. That there was something very, very poignant in that struggle for him. And what's interesting to me about Amos Oz's career is that it's the catalyst for his earliest writing. And he writes stories and also novels set in the kibbutz. Eventually he leaves much, much later on, but only because a child has asthma and it's told by the doctor that they should try not to live in an agricultural area anymore. And so he did another kind of pioneering by living in a very small development town above the Dead Sea, raising his family there. But Amos Oz eventually leaves the idea of the kibbutz entirely. And yet very late in life, as I write in that chapter, he feels compelled to return to re-examine the meaning of the kibbutz. There's something very beautiful to me and very personal about that, in that once you spend time in kibbutz, you always look at the world through the eyes of the kibbutznik. It's a filter that you always have with you, and you're always thinking about issues like justice and equality through that experience. And there's a kind of yearning for bettering society, for demanding more of society, for requiring that society be self-critical. And I think that shines through Oz's very, very late stories, which came out a couple of years ago very beautifully.
You mentioned when you were a young man and you moved to the kibbutz, you didn't have any idea of Palestinians or others. Tell us what's going on in Chapter 3. Who is Atala Mansour?
Okay, Atala Mansour is a very, very interesting individual. He's still alive, and he lives in Nasrat today. And he wrote really the first novel that a Palestinian wrote in Hebrew. He's sometimes a little bit under the radar, not sufficiently regarded. There's more famous novelists. But he wrote a very provocative story about an example of those who perpetually remain outsider to the kibbutz experiment. And one of my sharpest criticisms of the kibbutz is that it seems to be in many ways not at all a tribal idea, but there's universal aspirations in it. And I've often thought that if the kibbutz, which was the preeminent expression of Zionism for a very long time, if somehow more kibbutzim had found ways to accommodate Arabs, Palestinians, there would have been a way to give them a greater sense of belonging, a greater claim to having built up Israel, which I think they deserve. And in Atala Mansour's novel, there's a way in which you see a young person who's just come out of the bloody experience of 1948, suffered the very personal wrenching losses in the war, is trying to reimagine himself, reimagine new possibilities for himself by passing as a Jew in a kibbutz. And the response that he gets from that society, I think, is utterly fascinating. And Atala Mansour was one of the early Arab novelists, the Arab journalists working for Israel's version of New York Times, the newspaper known as Haaretz. And he wrote about Palestinian concerns and life in East Jerusalem there. But he actually lived for a time, roughly a year, in Shaar HaMakim, which is a kibbutz in northern Israel. And I think that he really understands what the kibbutz sought to achieve, but also is unsparing in talking about those that it excluded. And other stories that I deal with, including some by Amos Oz, reveal that there's others were excluded, others that are lower on the Zionist hierarchy of true belonging to Israel. And that includes Mizrahi Jews, Jewish immigrants, Jews who originate in the Arab countries. And the way their culture was completely dismissed and condescended to, and even when they were allowed to join kibbutzim, they were often discouraged from celebrating any kind of culture that wasn't sort of Eurocentric.
In chapter four, an interesting chapter, you focus on psychological thrillers, mysteries, as we see what you call disillusionment with some of the values of the kibbutz. What's going on there?
So Bat Yagur has this wonderful series, and I should say here that all of her mysteries are available in English translation. And her murder on kibbutz was written at a really compelling time of transition. Everything that's happened to the kibbutz movement that we've seen, where two-thirds of all the kibbutzim have become privatized, she's writing just when those the possibilities of those kinds of changes are being debated in the kibbutz movement. and they were highly contentious. And for the old timers, the veterans of the kibbutz dream, those changes were literally unbearable. And so there's this horrible crime, which is almost but not entirely unheard of, that takes place on the kibbutz that she writes about in her novel. And the other thing I should add is that the chief detective or protagonist in this novel, as well as her other novels, happens to be a Mizrahi Jew, a Jew of the Arab world. And he has his first foray in his entire life in the kibbutz while he's examining the murder. And in spite of himself, knowing that these people condescend to him and don't regard him as a true embodiment of civilization as they are, he still cannot resist some of the alluring ideal aspects of kibbutz life.
And then finally, chapter 5, after you've sort of described some of the changes that have gone on in the kibbutz, you mentioned privatization, people leaving the kibbutz, we start to see in the last 3-4 decades films about the kibbutz with a sense of nostalgia. Maybe start by telling us about Noah at 17. That seemed like a very interesting movie.
So Noah at 17 is interesting, and I thought it was essential to address it. We're not in kibbutz. We're in the life of a family that no longer lives on kibbutz, but the values of the kibbutz are still very, very much a part of their psychological and their emotional makeup. And they're arguing at a time that many people in Israel are divided between whether Israel is going to be allied with the West or to the Soviet Union. And there were entire kibbutzim that split off because of this debate, because of the intensity of it. It was like mini civil war in Israeli society, often forgotten about by Israelis today. But it was very consequential, and there were even family members who ended up not talking to each other for years and years or the rest of their lifetimes because of how bitterly this issue was struggled over. And what we see in Noah at 17 is the life of a very, very young woman who sees the hypocrisies of the adult world and the pain inflicted by those who are so doctrinaire that they lose the possibility of really loving each other. And so as a young person, she learns something very, very valuable about the limits of ideology and how short-sighted people are when they adhere more to ideology than they do to the needs of human beings. Noah at 17 sheds light on what this can be for in the kibbutz movement and what happens afterwards. And it's a great character study. I think it's one of the most compelling portraits of a young Israeli person, because she eventually, just as the adult world is collapsing around her, her relationships with the young people of her age, who are all completely bound to their identity as members of the youth movement, all of that falls apart, and she has to face the loneliness of being an actual individual because the youth movement can no longer satisfy her. She's kind of evolved beyond that, beyond the purity of belief, beyond the purity of conviction.
So, you know, when I was reading your book, I thought there were all these binaries, right? There's the individual and the collective. There's the socialist enterprise and the capitalist country. There's Arab and Jew. Are these binaries or tensions sources of creativity? You know, cultural production comes out of that tension?
I think so, to a certain extent. I mean, especially the one concerning the individual and the collective, because I think that any healthy society is always going to debate this issue. What does the collective owe the individual? And what does the individual owe the collective? I happen to think that in our own society, that is a question not sufficiently considered. And of course, as we see this election campaign revving up right now in the pronouncements that various people make, we really see that this is something that has not sufficiently been understood or grappled with in the United States. What's lost when we don't raise that question of what the collective owes the individual, what the individual owes the collective? So I think that while the kibbutz is often dismissed as no longer relevant and has succumbed to capitalism, that capitalism is won, so to speak, I think the jury may still be out on that. I even feel that with so much talk, every other week there seems to be a headline in some world newspaper, whether it's The Guardian or something else, about the end of capitalism. I think that we are living in an age of enormous anxiety, part of that because of terrorism, of course, but also because of the sense that the old models that were trusted are no longer viable. And another way that I think the kibbutz imagination is relevant and still resonates is that there are very real world applications for the kibbutz. There's Africans who have recently been to Israel and examined the kibbutz in its original traditional form and decided to return and apply its model to develop little kibbutzim in areas of the world where there's economic struggle and agricultural problems. So I think that the kibbutz still is a model. There's even been examples of young people applying it to city life. In other words, completely obviously divorced from an agrarian context, from an agricultural context. But the idea of a commune that is giving to its community. Because one of the things that I should have said in the beginning, if we're going to distinguish the kibbutz from all of the communes that preceded and followed it, is that while those often separated themselves from society, the kibbutz always thought of itself as a model for society. Not only that, but as something that really needed to be a leader, to be a kind of elite, to contribute to society.
Ronan, one final brief question. How has researching and writing the book changed the way you see the world?
Well, I have to admit that writing this project, first of all, I'm one of those lucky scholars, I think, that has been able, in a number of books, to be able to draw on lived experience. I did a book on the desert once. I did another book dealing with a military experience in Israel. And these things have all been very much a part of me. But when it comes to the kibbutz and reading the intensity of self-criticism in the writings of kibbutz writers, it's made me realize that kibbutz narratives demand a kind of consciousness of the writer, a kind of honesty, and are very, very much about the struggle to create a better world. And at the same time, I often came across some of the wounding aspects of the struggle to create a utopia. And I had to wean myself away from my own nostalgia toward kibbutz. But I think that there's something in this model of critical citizenship that the kibbutz still has to offer the world, and that Israel itself has become kind of impoverished by no longer being as interested or attuned to the need to interrogate issues concerning justice and equality. And that the rest of us need to think about that more seriously. What critical citizenship means.
Ronan, I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Imagining the Kibbutz, Visions of Utopia in Literature and Film, published this year by Penn State University Press. The author is Ronan Omer Sherman. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us. Check us out at newbooksinjewishstudies.com. You can download the podcast on iTunes, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Judaism. Got an idea for a book we should cover? Send us an email, newbooksinjewishstudies@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.